This meeting is now being recorded.
All right. Good evening, everyone, and apologies for a wee bit of a start. A few of you were texting in there about me telling the jokes. I'm not particularly good at that, and I'm not sure how to turn the music on either as well, but we got there in the end. So, look, welcome to the Red Meat Profit Partnership Farm Management Conference call. It's Wednesday, the 9th of September. I'm Aaron Meikle, and I'm the host for the call. This is the first of these calls we've done, which came out of a couple of suggestions from pilot farmers and processors. So we're looking forward to see how they're going, and we will be asking for your feedback at the end of the call. Just the purpose of this call is to test another way for you to access information and advice, which is obviously part of the Red Meat Profit Partnership project, and especially in ways that we can scale up to lots of farmers. So if this works well for our pilot farmers, it'll be something we can look out to roll out on a publicly around the country, because it's not sustainable, obviously, to get some of these key experts to each and every corner of the country. So hopefully technology can help. But before I move on and introduce Trevor, tonight's guest, just a bit of housekeeping. You may have heard we are recording the call, and a copy will be available in the next week or so as well for you to listen to at your leisure. Your lines are muted, so you can hear us. We can't hear you, so if you want to have a cup of tea, deal with the kids, one of you texted in that you were playing a drinking game while you're waiting, any of that sort of thing, go for it. You won't disturb us. But you can feel free to text in or email questions, so they will get to us. I'll be monitoring the lines, and I'll put them to our guest at the end of his session or as the appropriate time. We will be finished sharp, maybe just after 8:15. We'll see how we go. There's been plenty of questions, so we'll get cracking. I did a little bit of a survey with the processor reps, who each of you know from your various companies, and Trevor Cook was repeatedly mentioned as one of the key speakers, and he's also frequently identified in survey work as a trusted advisor or a key expert. And in my working career, certainly our paths have repeatedly crossed Trevor, whether it's on hogget lambing or body condition scoring or worm-wise stuff, all of which I guess we might hear a wee bit of about tonight. So welcome to the call, Trevor. I think you've just been overseas, so we're going to start with some prepared remarks, but what was the trip about when you're overseas, and are you still a wee bit jet-lagged?
Yes, I must admit I am, which is what caught me out tonight. Well,
you're excused.
Started in Mexico with some work just upskilling deer veterinarians around embryo transfer and the like, and saw some of those New Zealand sheep that looked very healthy in Mexico, and then moved on to Scotland, where Quality Meat Scotland, your equivalent, of beef and lamb, is working very hard to get farmers to relearn how to graze animals on pastures, get their animals outside, and take a whole lot of their costs out of their systems. So it was back to basics around grazing systems.
Good. Now modern technology, Twitter, and all these things. I was keeping a track on whereabouts and whose place you were visiting in the in the UK. There's no privacy these days, but anyway, bit of a preamble to where you've been. So look, I'll hand over to you for a wee while, and then when you're done, we can have some questions and answers. How's that?
Okay. Well, just on the basis of being in control of what we do on farms, I think we do need to come back to basics. Farmers get bombarded with a huge amount of information, and I must admit some of it's conflicting, but I think not necessary. But that's not really the issue. I think the quality of information that farmers get can make it difficult to really identify those key things that do make a difference. And really, in all systems, all farming systems, there are just a few things that make most of the difference to the outcome, whereas if you listed all the things that could be a bit daunting. So just identifying those key things and almost scheduling them to make sure that they're first of all identified, but then scheduled in some way so that they can be enacted upon or acted on to influence the outcomes. In breeding systems, there's some very clear dates that we work around or should be worked around in terms of making most efficient use of pastures, but setting up systems to get the best out of animals, but also to be in the best position when things don't go according to plan. And in finishing systems, the same rules apply. It's just that it's slightly more flexible, probably, but making sure that the rules that drive live weight gains in particular are sort of kept in mind and coming back to make sure you reach targets and achieve outcomes that were set out in the first place. And sitting behind those sort of things, there are things like animal health, which always sits there as a potential limitation to achieving outputs. But animal health, again, identify the issues and put plans around minimising the potential impacts of animal health intrusions. But really, most of the outcomes we see in our production systems are around feed. So what feed do they need, when do they need it, and how do we make most efficient use of the feed that we've got? I think that pretty well sums up what would be nice to be sort of to expand on with questions.
All right. Do you want to go straight into some of the questions and discussion and bits and pieces now?
Yeah, well, I think we can because we can expand on things as questions come in.
Good as gold. No, well, there's a couple I've sort of had in or noted myself, and one of the things in the project is around scheduling and getting that attention to detail and timing right. What do you sort of use, or what do you advocate in terms of a formal planning tool or just a written tool, or how do you go about that with your clients?
No, well, as time's gone on, I've got more and more simple. I've simplified it more and more and more. So for sheep breeding systems, for example, I set some very specific dates that all bounce out of a mating date of a ewe flock, which clearly delineate when certain feeding levels are important or when they're not important. And so I call it my sheep plan, which is just a series of dates that drop out from the mating date that indicate when a different level of feeding is appropriate to get out the best outcomes. I've gone away from the value of having a whole lot of written notes because they, like any of us, we don't tend to go through them. It's easier to miss things, whereas it's a very simple form that just runs out the important dates with some explanation behind them, I've found is the most effective way to sort of get those sort of things implanted in systems. So identifying and scheduling, I guess, is the brief description of that.
Yep, and getting things done at the right time and the right way. So just where we are at the moment in terms of the production season for a breeding ewe flock, what's the next one that would be coming up on your sheep plan, key time of the year for breeding ewes?
Given that now ewes have, depending on where we are, but lambing is generally sort of getting underway or getting very close, and it's very hard to change anything at this stage if we're into a very late pregnancy, and certainly for a lot of flocks up this way, lambing's well underway, if not finished. So once ewes have lambed, it's identifying where we are. So in most flocks, from the planned start of lambing, around about 10 days later, we can identify what is the mean lambing date, so when half the flock's lambed, which is the date which we take the stage of lactation from. So we might start lambing on the 1st of September, but if we take the average start of lactation, it's going to be around the 10th or 11th of September. So it's really just the date to refer back to when we're looking at age of lamb when we wean in particular. Then we are the next date, which is one that's very hard to influence because we are into the spring where we don't have a lot of control, but it's certainly one that we can be aiming for is when the ewes are hitting peak lactation, which is going to be around about 3 to 4 weeks after that mean lambing date. And at peak lactation, those ewes, it can be a scheduled identified time. It's around 3 or 4 weeks after that mean lambing date. At that time, ewes have got maximum intake. They can eat more than they can at any other time of the year. And and it just happens when you reflect on lambings and when farms were shortest over the spring, it so often coincides with that time when most of the flock is hitting peak lactation, because their demand at that time is very high. Important thing about identifying that is that after the ewes have hit peak lactation, every day from then on they're producing a little bit less milk. So therefore, every day after peak lactation, a bit more of the lamb's diet is pasture. So when we look at lactation, well, we look at the period, well, lactation and the times when what has most influence on lamb growth rate. In that first 8 weeks, lamb growth rate is very much, if not totally, driven by the ewe lactation performance. And that ewe lactation and performance is influenced by how well she was fed coming into lambing, her condition score when she did lamb, and I believe to a lesser extent the feed she's got round her once she has lambed, because she can use her body condition very effectively to drive early lactation. But that first 8 week lamb live weight gain is driven by that ewe. But once we get beyond 8 weeks, that lamb growth rate is more and more and more driven by the quality of pasture that suckling lamb has access to. Remembering that about 70% of the feed that multiple lamb consumes from birth to weaning is pasture. So the quality of pasture that the suckling lamb has access to is vital in driving the ultimate weaning weight. So that when we look at where we can influence that, and that timing in the second half of lactation, trying to maintain high quality pasture that the lamb can have, the thought needs to be going to when the lamb starts competing with its mother for the quality pasture that's available. One of the challenges we have is as the spring progresses, we get into late spring, summer starts getting close, pasture quality so easily can start to decline. So the sort of pasture that's suitable for a lamb to grow fast is becoming less and less and less. It just happens that the ewe also likes that high-quality pasture, so the lamb gets it into a situation where it can competing with its mother for limited quality feed, and at that point lamb growth rates will really decline. I think one of the things that we get trapped into is weaning date. We plan weaning date around lots of things other than when is the best time to wean from the lamb's point of view. And I think if we had an easy way of knowing how fast lambs were growing, we would be changing our weaning dates a lot more than we tend to. The tendency is to be weaning at the same time every year, but every year is different, and the time in the feed situation any one year is going to have a big impact on what those lambs are doing when they wean at weaning.
So just on that one, Trevor, that was sort of a question that came in. You know, just where we are in the cycle, we can't do much about the condition score ewes were at or pasture covers when lambing started. But weaning date is something that's still in front of us. We've got some. What are the information you'd be telling your clients to gather or to help make that decision? What would they be, if it's a flexible decision, what do you base it on?
Well, it's one of the ones that's very hard to do, because we've really got to be mindful of what is happening at a pasture level and try and interpret what it's allowing that suckling lamb to consume. And so it's a combination of pasture cover and pasture quality. And it really is just looking at observing pastures and trying to make a judgment. But I think it's one of the very difficult times in the farming cycle to have some good information about what is happening. It'd be nice if we could be weighing lambs on a very frequent basis, but from a practical point of view, that's not possible. A lot of people say, what's the ewe condition? But by the time we can visually see ewe condition being lost, it's almost too late. And we know at that point that we probably should have intervened earlier. So I must admit, from an advice point of view, it's one of the bit, it's one of the areas that's very hard to be very specific, because it is very much something that has to be assessed at the time. But having said all that, so much of weaning is driven by other factors, such as the anticipation of what the weather's going to be, anticipation of what the price is going to be, labour resources that might be available that are all fitted around weaning. So when you look at the whole cycle of ewe, I think that late lactation and weaning date is one of the more messy parts of that whole cycle in terms of getting the best outcome and making the best decisions.
So just in terms of things that are on the radar or potentially on the radar in the next wee while, and this is a bit of a hardy annual about internal parasites and lambs at foot.
Yeah.
I know you've covered a lot, but it's certainly people, it comes up every year. Do we drench lambs before weaning? Do we wait to weaning? What's your, there might not be any hard, fast rules, but what should people be looking out for to make that decision?
Well, again, we've hit one of those very difficult ones, because the tools that we might use to trigger drenching suckling lambs, I don't think apply to a suckling lamb. Certainly we have lots of cases where lambs run at quite high fecal egg counts but are growing very fast. The impact of worms in a suckling lamb are way, way less than the impact of worms once they are weaned. The exception to all that is way down south, where Nematodirus can be a significant player in limiting lamb growth rates. But that is one worm which can be monitored through fecal egg counts, and that monitoring be the basis for drenching. But in general, there is no clear evidence about the live weight gain response to drenching suckling lambs yet. Anecdotally, we do see what appears to be significant responses, but certainly there's a lot of trial data that does not support significant growth rate responses to drenching suckling lambs, but I certainly would never categorically say that we shouldn't be drenching suckling lambs.
Oh. The other one, so Sydney, in my part of the country, Central South Island, had been played with a wee bit. The New Zealand system of creek grazing lambs, where we're using a modified gate to let lambs go into the next paddock in the rotation ahead of ewes and pick out the quality pasture, so reducing the competition. Any thoughts on that or experience with that?
Oh, no, I think that's a wonderful tool. I have had some experience with that, and it just highlights the huge part of pasture quality for driving lamb growth rates, where those lambs can creep forward and get first access to the quality feed ahead, and we know what it does to lamb growth rates. It's a significant increase in lamb growth rates. I think we're using lambs are being rotated in systems that aren't huge. I think creep grazing is a big opportunity to just get more out of those systems. But in more extensive systems where ewes and lambs are being rotated, it's much, much more difficult to get it to work. But in more intensive systems, I love it. I think it's a underutilised tool for getting heavier weaning weights.
Yep. So again, pretty hard to be specific, but when you talk about the difference between intensive and extensive, how big are mobs, how big are paddocks, would you see it still have a role, or is it more topography?
Yeah, it's more to topography, because we've tried it on some of the more extensive farms, you know, where they've sort of got the 15 hectare paddocks that are still being able to set up rotations. It's much harder to get them started, much harder to get the lambs aware of where the gates are to be creeping through. Whereas in more intensive ones, it's relatively easy to get it started by concentrating ewes and lambs by the gate, and lambs start sneaking through and others follow them through, but haven't had anywhere near the success, in fact almost failure, in more extensive systems to get enough lambs to go through to make it worthwhile. And I don't know the
numbers,
things where numbers and areas sort of interact, so it's sort of no specifics, but you know, in, where we've got paddocks that are around sort of 4 to 5 hectares, it is much easier to set up. But beyond that, particularly on hill country, my experience is just hard to get the lambs, enough lambs caught up in the system to be wanting to push through and creep.
We're going to do a follow-up email to people with the link to the recording. I'll stick a link on there as well. There's a fact sheet Beef and Lamb have, which gives you some background on that if somebody's interested. And it's something that most people could probably still implement this lambing if they were keen.
Good idea.
All right, so we got through to sort of talking about things between now and weaning. Anything else we've missed, or are we sort of starting now to talk about what people can do from weaning onwards?
I think the important thing is to be thinking of weaning as a moving date, because it's going to the appropriate time to wean in terms of getting weaning lambs so that when they are weaned, they're still growing, because they make that transition from weaning to off their mums onto other feed much better. If they're growing well at the time that happens, whereas if we wait until their growth rates have dropped right off, it seems to be much more of a stress on them. We get much more of a weaning check. So where weaning can be altered according to the situations, I think it's something that should be looked at rather than just sticking to a set weaning date.
So come weaning, you've then got the ewes and lambs separate, obviously, and for the ewes, it's almost, you know, it's start of another production cycle. They've done their job, got the lambs off. So what ewe management things do you want, you know, people should be thinking about whenever they decide to wean? What's, rather than just sticking the ewes out of the way on a back paddock, what would you suggest they should be keeping an eye on?
Well, that's what we used to do, is put them in the back paddock. But I think if we want to get most of that out of our ewes, we shouldn't be doing that. At some point, relatively soon, I mean, it would be nice to do it at weaning, but weaning's often too busy to do it. But sometime after, ewe sorting, ewe culling, to go through and take out those ewes below condition score 3, because those are the ewes that are going to have the biggest impact on the scanning percentage. So something close to weaning is, and often it'll be around shearing time, is to be taking out the lighter condition ewes and beginning a process of what I call rescuing them, getting their condition back up to 3 or so by the time we get to mating. At some point, though, in that whole process, we need to be going through and culling ewes, well, checking ewes for teeth, feet and udders. I think that's an area where the disciplines around ewe soundness aren't as vigorously applied as they would have been in the past. So checking udders, because we've got good data around udder health and its effect on weaning weight. Any lumps around the udder, around the udder, udders that are not symmetrical, both of those sort of defects are going to be associated with lower weaning weights of lambs. The lactate, they can't, just will not produce as much milk. And equally, sound feet, sound mouths are necessary if we're going to get the most out of ewes. So looking, rather than just culling on age, culling also on physical defects. So that's all something that surrounds weaning or just after, surrounds shearing around and that sort of time. So that I think the important thing is that we shouldn't be really shutting ewes down at that stage. They still need to be fed, although they can be a good condition ewe can be maintained on relatively poor pastures. But to put condition on ewes, they do need to have access to quality pasture to put condition on to get back to where they should be for mating.
This is a bit of a leading question because I know the answer, but you're a fairly big, a strong advocate of body condition scoring, I presume. Yeah. What key dates for ewes, and what about body condition scoring for cows? So there's two questions there. When, you know, key times people should be putting their hands on ewes, and then what's its role in beef cattle management?
Okay. Well, I have three body condition dates we use, if we're really going to focus on that, because our scanning percentage and our ultimate lamb survival and new lamb growth rate is going to be so much driven by the number of ewes that are below three, either at mating or at lambing. So the 3 dates are sometime around weaning that we intervene, take out those ones below three. The other one is 6 weeks before mating, before tuffing, because it's 6 weeks before we still have time to rescue those ewes below three. So those are 2 dates that are very interventionist because ewes are coming in and it is a very physical process to go through and take out lighter ewes. The other date that's underutilized is when ewes come in for scanning. So when ewes go, the person pushing ewes into the scanning crate should be trained in condition scoring. As they push those ewes into the scanning crate, they mark the ones that are below three. And if those ewes come out the other end of the scanning crate with a multiple mark on them as well, there's a huge opportunity to make more money out of that ewe by lifting her condition so she lambs in at a condition score three. So for sheep, it's very well defined. With cows, for cows, just to complicate it, we work on a scale of 1 to 10, just so we can't just extrapolate it from sheep. And we know that our beef cows operate at the sweet, so-called sweet spot for our cows is to sort of around 4.5 to 7 condition score, where we have flexibility in what we can do with them, but also at condition score where they can perform well. So we know that we get lower conception rates with them if they're too light at mating. We know that if they calve and if they're below that sort of magical 5 or 4.5, I tend to work on 5, that they'll produce less colostrum, they'll have a poor lactation performance, their calves will be born with less vigour, so more at risk of not getting through. So having points to intervene to take out lighter cows should be part of the calendar, and I think that's an area which often isn't necessarily done. So those times when that can be done is in the intervention time would be the a month before calving starts, when we know that cows should not be losing condition before they calve. It's very hard to intervene between calving and mating necessarily to have to take lighter cows out, but if calf marking is early enough to allow that to happen, it's a chance to take out lighter cows and drench them and give them better feed. But the real opportunity to pick up those lighter cows is at weaning. So we're not taking light cows into the winter. Pick up those lighter cows, but ideally intervene again at some stage during the winter to pick up the cows that aren't coping, that are not up to the right condition, and do something just to, number one, stop them losing condition, but then number two, to try and lift that condition before they calve, because there's so much production to be got from them, extra production, if they can calve in the right condition score, sort of around that 5 to 7.
Great. All right, look, just keep an eye on time, and we've had quite a few questions in, so some of them are going to jump around a wee bit, but I might just work through them sort of in order they came in and try and clear them up. First question is around, what's happening at the moment. I think this is a farmer in North Canterbury, so obviously you've been under a bit of stress there with the drought and feeding a lot of hard feed. Starting to have some lamb loss issues at the moment. One, lambs are looking a bit bloated and sort of gaseous. Any suggestions on what that might be? We're sort of talking around 2 to 3 days old and they're dying. So,
number of things.
Livestock, feedstock.
Yeah, I've got no direct sort of comment on that because I'm thinking it could be a number of things, but to do that, is suggesting action, but depends very much on their lambing situation. Well, my advice is to get some chopped up, because I could come up with a whole number of things, but really most got to be something else going on the side to make them bloated, which would be apparent if they were autopsied.
All right. And the other one, no, that's all right. Difficult to do it without being hands-on, I can imagine. The other one is actually quite good lambs, but with hindquarter paralysis. Likely causes of that? And this is,
right. Two things to look at there. One is the spinal abscesses. So for younger lambs that have got hind limb paralysis, it almost always will be a spinal abscess. So infection's got in the umbilicus, in the navel. The whizzed around that might have dropped off in the joint, so we've got arthritis that might have dropped off in the liver, so if we see it at slaughter, it might have a little abscess in the liver, or it might have by chance dropped off in the spinal cord and is putting pressure on the spinal cord. It's dropped in the backbone and putting pressure on the spinal cord. And there's really nothing you can do about that. You just can't change that outcome. If the lambs are a little bit older, into the equation has got to be copper deficiency or a calcium phosphorus imbalance. I've seen both for paralysis or loss of use of back legs, no, just copper. So copper deficient lambs will as they grow faster, as lactation goes on, their nerve systems into their back legs fail, and they just gradually lose control of their back legs. So sway back is the classical sign of copper deficiency and will occur in lambs that are growing fast, tends to be in the second half of lactation, and again, really can't do anything that makes much difference to that outcome. It's a warning to look ahead and do something next pregnancy to get copper into those ewes during pregnancy, so the lambs are born with sufficiently developed nervous systems for that not to occur.
Okay.
So unfortunately, that syndrome, and both of them at the time are very hard to, well, nothing really changes the outcome.
Is it possible, I understand this is in drought area, had quite a lot of high intake of supplementary feed, particularly sheep nuts and so on, is it possible that's contributed to it, or is it just like a vitamin G or... Is there any possible link there?
Presumably, those lambs have been... They're generally earlier-born lambs, aren't they, for that area?
They will have been, I imagine. Yeah.
I think that would be more at a stage where copper deficiency might be expected, and has that occurred because of a major change of diet that the sheep have had that has lowered their copper stores, which has then run into lambs that the myelin sheaths running, controlling around the nerves going to the back legs haven't developed properly. It will be related to something in the feeding which has just changed the copper status. The spinal abscess one, though, we normally see most of that coming out of wet springs where the lambs have got more infection.
Mm-hmm.
They've been exposed to more infection at the time they were born, which I doubt whether it's been the case.
Yeah, tricky ones to deal with at a distance over a conference call, but interesting to consider the options. Just another one that's coming. So, again, this is sort of probably prior planning for next year, but losses of triplet ewes. What's typical, or what would you think would be good practice? What sort of losses should we aim for? And what are the keys? What are the what's causing them to die, and what can we do to stop it happening? There you go. You got half an hour.
Yeah. Well, triplet ewes are all the rules that we put around multiple ewes in terms of condition and feeding levels. We've got a bit of flexibility with twinning ewes. They can surprisingly get by if we don't get it right. But triplet ewes don't tolerate not getting it right, so they don't. So in terms of that lamb loss, it hinges right back. Most of it comes right back to the way those triplet ewes were managed in late pregnancy and how they lambed. So triplet ewes don't tolerate lambing don't tolerate being skinny or fat. My experience, both extremes will result in poorer outcomes. They don't tolerate losing condition in late pregnancy. and those and the Massey work looking at triplet lambs strongly indicates that the amount of colostrum that those triplet lambs got has a big influence on their longer term survival. So they might be hanging around for one or two or even 3 weeks looking for bonny, and then one drops off and dies. There's a good chance that those lambs didn't get enough colostrum, and it's really impacted on their ability to survive. And that colostrum production is so much influenced by condition score and feeding coming into lambing, which are both things that we can influence if we put if we put management around those ewes to have them lambing in the right condition and being fed adequately coming into lambing. And so how do you achieve that at lambing? I mean, I've got clients that are lambing triplets on hills that are sort of doing around the 230, even 240%. And I've got other clients that are intensively managing triplets in terms of intervening. Yes, they do overall get better outcomes, but the labour input would maybe counter some of those. But I think triplets can be managed on hills with still good outcomes. What's really changed the face of triplet lambing is though is plantain. I'm just so impressed with the ability of triplet ewes on plantain to deliver high lamb survival and good live weight gain lambs. So something in plantain is allowing those triplet ewes to be probably metabolically very stable, which is translating through to them producing more vigorous lambs with enough colostrum to have really good outcomes. I like triplets. I think triplets are a real opportunity to exploit high scannings to really add profit to a system. Whereas a lot of farmers get a bit frightened of triplets because they have bad experiences, but they can be managed to be really contributing to your lamb crop.
Oh, nicely done on the plantain too, because that was the second part of the question. So well done, you anticipated that. We're getting a wee bit past time, but I will go a wee bit longer given we're a wee bit later starting. So I've got two main questions and then chance for any wrap-up comments. This one's a bit of an interesting one. Does a high protein diet limit fat lay down on a finishing lamb in late winter?
I wouldn't have thought so, but I mean, I say that and I don't know, but number one, where would a high protein diet come from in late winter? What does constitute a high protein diet? Given that on some of our pastures, finishing lambs are eating a very high protein diet and growing very well. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah. And there you go.
Given that protein does cost, is it something that we even encounter? I'll leave that one.
All right. Might see if we can find anything out in the meantime anyway, and perhaps flick it out in the follow-up. And so, look, the last question, and this is a wee bit of a change from sort of looking internal, but you've just been in the UK. What did you see over there that you're over there talking about our systems, though, from what I understood you at the start? What about what you saw over there that we could adopt and that you think would fit into our systems back here?
Can I be arrogant enough to say nothing?
You're amongst friends on this call.
Well, I know them over there well enough that they can accept that. But really, there's a lot of improvement we can do on a lot of farms to get more production out of them. But overall, we've got very good systems that deliver a lot out of pasture. And in moving farming systems that are based around a lot of concentrate feeding, a lot of intervention into outdoor systems based around pasture is a big transition for those farmers. And I just really don't know that they're doing anything that we really can pick up and apply to our systems. There's a lot of talk over there about protected proteins and to use coming into lambing. really in our capacitor systems, there's very little evidence that they make any difference. And really, if it is, the biggest impacts are still around condition score and feeding levels. And I don't think, I'm not convinced at all that protected proteins are going to make any difference in our pastoral systems. So no, I don't come back with the messages thinking, right, this will make a difference to what I'm doing at all.
Well, that's a good message in and of itself. What about, I mean, are they seeing much higher ewe survival, lamb survival with their systems versus what we are, or is that sort of something that is a bit of a myth as well?
No, well, the ewes indoors under full intervention certainly are achieving some very high lambing percentages. So ewes scanning around 250% and with tailing or docking percentages of around 160 or even 170, that will never occur with outdoor lambing. But the costs of those systems, the feed costs are just gobbling up all their profit. So one of the concepts that some of them are finding hard to grasp are having a lower level of productivity but actually making more money. So with much, much lower feed costs by using pastures, certainly lamb survival is low, although surprisingly not as low as what they were probably expecting. The overall outcomes from well-managed pastoral systems, given that they're generally not lambing on hills like us are, they're in much, much better lambing platforms than we would have. The outcomes are surprisingly not that much behind what they would get with a much more intensive lambing. But what the real interesting bit of information or observation that I've made is our losses between tailing and weaning generally are very low. In their systems, those losses are much higher than ours, which probably reflects that those lambs are being born into a much more contaminated environment. And infection, the intensive lambing might be allowing higher survival at the time of lambing, but it's certainly potentially setting them up for a higher loss rate later as a consequence of higher levels of contamination at lambing time. But I've certainly seen farms over there that have moved to outdoor lambings and are still achieving very good outcomes, so it can be done.
All right. Great, thanks, Trevor. Look, on that note, we've gone a wee bit later because we did start a wee bit later as well, but I think we'll call it to a close there. And thank you very much for your time. Look, I'll be in touch the next day or two. There's a number of things you've talked about. I think we can send out links to follow-up documents or supporting material and so on. And to those of you that were on the call, we will be flicking out for a bit of feedback from you as well. We ended up with quite a sheep concentrated call this time. We didn't have many questions coming from the beef side of things, but we'll certainly focus on that because we've got a number of our farmers who are running mainly or completely beef systems up north. But I'll call it to a close there, Trevor. I think you sound like you need to get off to, you've had a fair bit of travel and around the world, so I won't keep you up too late tonight. But hey, look, thanks as always. It's always enjoy talking to you with your breadth of knowledge. And thank you to all you out there who dialed in. The recording will be available soon if you want to go through it, and we'll be flicking out to you a bit of a survey to get your feedback on where we go with the next call in about a month's time. So thank you all, and good night.
Okay. Good.
Thanks, Trevor.
See you. All the best. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.